coming community members. Dean and Makiko, it's great to see you, and thanks for the group for coming. So my problem is that I have a bit of a cold. I hope I'm not going to be too blurry and snotty, although I guess most of my images are going to be blurry. So don't worry about that. That's on purpose. And I hope I can get through my material. If you find I'm getting too carried away and wordy, I hope you'll stop me and say, get to the point already, so we can get through it. Anyhow, my topic is this, facilitation as an everyday practice, and the concept of the participant facilitator and process work. I wanted to tell you a little bit about why I chose this topic. We've all to be facilitators, and many of us won't immediately have a practice or jobs as facilitators, and we've worked incredibly hard to learn the awareness skills and everything else over the last 3 years, or some of us longer. And I wanted to make a plea almost, and a case for using what we've learned not only when we're hired and getting paid and doing a job, but in our everyday interactions, in our families, in our relationships, in our current workplaces. And for me, the way I thought about it, I thought, well, I might as well do an internship. So one of my internship projects was to take what I learned theoretically from reading Arne's books and study what he advocates in terms of this shift in awareness that's required to actually see yourself both as a participant and a facilitator at the same time. And to see if I could learn it, if I could apprentice myself to that, if I could do some of the things that Arne advocates for, actually, if it actually worked, because he makes some pretty high claims for that. He says things like, if we could do this, our workplaces would be amazing, our institutions would be exciting, our meetings would be fun. All those things, I'll give it a try. So basically it was a way of testing what was laid out in the books theoretically and putting it into practice. So what I'll do is my paper on which this talk is based has a couple of strands. It has a theoretical strand where I'm actually looking for instances where Arne discusses participation or the participant, and where he also talks about facilitation specifically. Of course, he talks about facilitation all the time, but specifically where it becomes clear what he means when he says facilitate. What do we do when we facilitate? And so I'm following those expressions or those terms from his early books on in World Work, like Year One, Leader as a Martial Artist, Sitting in the Fire to Deep Democracy, and see how and when the concept of the participant facilitator actually starts being used. Because it doesn't at first, when Arne talks about facilitation, that's not a concept that he uses. That comes, I think the first time he uses it in writing, and he may have used it verbally, orally in his presentations and lectures sooner, but it appears for the first time in 2002 in Deep Democracy. And before then, it's there as a concept, but it's not named that. So there's the theoretical part in my thesis, and then there are these cases where there are just little anecdotes about my own experiences where I wished I could have been a participant facilitator, where I thought I did good, and where I tried to be one and didn't succeed, and then afterwards did inner work to see what interventions could I have made or might I be able to make next time around. So long introduction. Again, also, when I said the concept of the participant facilitator and process work, I'm not trying to sort of give a definitive reading of that. It's very personal, I think, and everyone will look at the same text bits that I looked at and get maybe a totally different reading. So it's very much, I think, positional, motivated by my own experiences, by my own agenda, by my own interpretation. So anyhow, I just wanted to say that. So I'd like to start talking actually about but with a little story, something that happened to me that was kind of life-changing. About 10 years ago, my sister and I were taking a train to attend an art exhibit in Germany. We were taking a train from Stuttgart to Cologne, which is just a little bit south of Bonn. Bonn at that time was still the capital of Germany. This was in the early 90s when Germany for the first time was being asked by, I think, the United States to join in military efforts in the Balkans, in Kosovo. And there were huge peace demonstrations happening all the time, like hundreds of thousands of people marching against Germany's involvement. I should say I'm German, for those of you who might not know that. Huge demonstrations against that. We were going to an art exhibition on a Saturday morning, but so were thousands of people catching the same train we were to attend a peace march. At the same time, there was a National League soccer game going on in Bonn also, and there were all these soccer fans who'd been drinking since, I don't know, maybe the night before, also on the train. So the train was full. And then these different, you can see this is already a group process starting, these different populations all crammed in the train. It's a 4-hour train ride. And we were riding in the train, my sister and I reading magazines, this guy sitting opposite us, a very intellectual looking scrawny guy with a little, you know, wire glasses, reading his paper. Everybody was going about their business, but there was a charged atmosphere with the guys getting really looped and drunk. You can drink in public in Germany at any time. So these guys were the soccer fans were getting really out of hand. And the colored woman walked, you know, down the aisle in the middle of this car, and one of the drunken fools yelled a racial slur at her. In translation, basically, it was something like, shush, 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 nigger, go back to the bush. And they kept repeating that. And I remember kind of getting paralyzed and sitting there, dumbfounded, wanting to say something, but couldn't. And I think a lot of people had the same reaction. What do you do now? And experiencing paralysis. And the guy in the horn, the nickel, the glasses that I described, had been reading a very intellectual paper, put it down, looked at the drunken fools in the corner and said something like, you can't do that here, I won't allow it, which was very escalating. The brawny guys got up and started gesturing. It looked like a brawl was going to happen. Thank God the peace people were in the train. I think they had some training in, I don't know what, passive resistance. So a purpley clad, purple and turquoise woman, I remember standing up while I'm still trying to think, what should I say? What could I do? This woman stands up next to the guy and says, I support the man in the glasses, with the glasses. So suddenly this guy wasn't alone anymore. There were two. At that point, I woke up and I thought, well, at least I could join them, right? So I stood with the three of them. There were now two fronts. It didn't look good. There was going to be something. In the meantime, though, somebody smarter than all of us had gone to get the train conductor. He talked to the out of control guys and kicked them out of the train, actually, at the next stop. But, you know, so no harm done, but lots of harm done. No facilitation. The group process starting, and I mean, I didn't know it 10 years ago about facilitation, but I knew that somehow I'd failed by my own standards. I'd had this rapid heartbeat. I wanted to do something. I couldn't do it. And I think that those years of contemplating that moment as a German, which also this not being able to do anything, connected me right back to my childhood, where I would hear story after story, post-war Germany, about, well, we couldn't do anything. We didn't know. We didn't know what to do. How could we? Brought me right back to that point. I thought, I got to learn. I got to learn what it is that needs to be happening. And I think process work led me to this whole idea that what was needed and what's often needed is a facilitator, a participant facilitator, somebody who has an overview and could have brought those group into contact with each other. That's just a little story I'll return to later, because I want to also finish it with the inner work piece that will show how I, had I known what I now know, might have intervened there as a participant facilitator. God knows how it would have gone, but anyway. Anyway, so the question that I want to look at it when I started writing my project was, well, what actually is facilitation? What is a facilitator? What do we do? Yes, basic. Maybe you all know the answer, but I was kind of not that clear. And what is a participant? And, you know, depending on where you look, what angle you take on that, those questions, you're going to come up with different answers. Process work has very particular answers to what do we mean by facilitation. That's quite different from what another paradigm might mean. And the same with the participant. So the participant, I think Penny asked this group in our peer group, what is a citizen? Because that came up in a definition of something. She said, where does Arnie get this concept of a citizen? But so the participant is the citizen. It's the you and me out there, the group participant, the us participating in our world. And it's a participation is a question of how do we participate in decision-making processes, economic, political decision-making. It's a question of being democratically involved in, or not in, in our cultures, in our society. So how do we participate? Do we have a position? Can we participate? Are we involved in what happens in our political systems, or are we not? And then it's also a question of personal choice or personal attitude. Do we feel empowered? Do we feel like we have something to offer in a situation, or don't we? I wasn't a very active participant in the on the train, but I was nonetheless a participant, you know. So facilitation for us is slightly different also from a mainstream definition where you have a set of skills and you might even have a set of given interventions that you apply to a particular situation. When I Googled facilitator on, that image, a Google image, I wanted to, it was a white guy standing in front of a blackboard, a whiteboard, a flip chart. So I think there's this concept that facilitation is somebody who stands in front of a flip chart and does something with groups. When I looked up the word in a dictionary, in one of the most scholarly dictionaries, it wasn't even in there yet. It was there as a draft edition, and it, as sort of describing what we commonly understand as a facilitator. But it's an emerging profession, actually. So it's not even a word yet. And just as a little aside, when I looked up facilitator and when it was first used in the English language was in 1824 or something, and it was a razor. The facilitator was an instrument that facilitated shaving. So that's why that stopped there. I thought it was hilarious, right? So, but it's to remember that the facilitator is it's an emerging profession, and it starts to sort of get used in the 60s as a professional designation. And so it's also a profession that's being invented to some extent, right? That what we do, how we conduct ourselves is in the making and in process work too. I know this might be obvious to you, but to me it wasn't, is how it's all being made as we speak, how it's an evolving paradigm, how nothing is quite fixed. That becomes clear when you read the books chronologically, how terms change, how they disappear, how they come into being. So my project really brought me in touch with the fact that nothing is written in stone yet. It's all being made. We're part of it. And that's a point that I wanted to make, because it's easy to forget that something is being made as you're learning it, you know? We're so part of this emergence. So in Deep Democracy, Arnie talks about the obvious facilitator. As somebody, you know, like we are trained, we think of ourselves as the obvious facilitators. We stand in front of the room. The quote here is, the obvious facilitator stands at the front, yet many others can ably facilitate the whole process from any position in the room. In fact, those on the sidelines can be helpful, sometimes even more helpful than the identified facilitators who get most of the focus. So that quotation really thrilled me, because I'm thinking about facilitating from any position, not just the of course, he's talking about group process here. I'm taking it more generally facilitating from any position. But specifically here, he's talking about what sometimes happens in group processes when someone in the group suddenly has the awareness and comes in and becomes the facilitator, even though that person is not the designated facilitator. I don't know if you've been in a situation like that where you facilitated and you kind of don't know what to do, and suddenly some participant does something, does the intervention that advances the process. And that's how we generally understand participant facilitation, right? So this, the normal group member suddenly occupies this role that's mine. And that could be kind of almost threatening too, you know, when you're facilitating, thinking that somehow you failed, that you should have known. And I wanted to point out that no, in fact, it's, and Arne says it's a wonderful moment actually in a group process when that happens, because it's a sign that the facilitator is only, it's a role amongst many, and it doesn't belong to the designated facilitator. It is shared, and it's a great moment when someone in the group actually takes over that role. Am I making sense so far, or going too fast? Or I don't know how long I've spoken, but you'll stop me. This is a sort of a stupid image of these roles that I just wanted to say it's like one of many roles. And the other point I wanted to make is that these roles are unoccupied. That one of the points Arne makes is that the facilitator role is the least occupied role amongst all of the roles that we are aware of. The least adequately occupied role is how he says it, of all the roles, even less occupied than the evil disturber. That really surprised me. So in other words, Arne, when he starts writing about world work in the year one, says that. I love that quote, because he is in effect saying the facilitator is a ghost role, and I'm going to represent it. My work is to represent, to unfold this ghost role, and my books are in part that. That's my project, is to not only unfold it, but then also to create trainings that will populate this role. I'm going to train people who will be able to fill these unoccupied roles. I know this is a dumb image, but I thought maybe it's an important image for us to remember about the occupation of the role, and that we don't get too identified as professional facilitators, that it's ours. No, it's like for everyone, and everyone should occupy these slots. Anyway, hope it works. What's my next? So that's just to reiterate what I just said. That's the actual quote from year one. I'll read it. Today, the role of the globally wise facilitator, which is what he called the participant, I'm saying the globally wise facilitator is sort of a precursor of the facilitator participant, is less adequately filled than any other role, even less than the evil disturber, thus creating and populating the new facilitator. That's what he's doing. With all of its differing viewpoints, is a matter of planetary life and death. So it's a serious matter. That's another point I wanted to make, that for Arne, if that role isn't occupied, the world is a scary place. The world is like that train scene where the authorities have to come in, kick off the disturbers. We can't all stay on the same bus or train or whatever, you know? And it's not a good world. Scary world. So, well, let me just see where I am. Again, I'm just reiterating that point again, that the facilitator brings awareness is the next important point. Far beyond anything else, whatever other skills and methods we might have, the primary tool, the primary spice addition is awareness that we're bringing to a scene. And he says that this role can be filled by anyone, and that it's the facilitator comes in a lineage of important roles like the shamans and priests in the past that were exclusively, I think, occupied by people who had hereditary rights usually to it. Arne says this is no longer the case. Each one of us, if we have this awareness, are in a way aligned with these ancient practitioners and can help the world. So in Deep Democracy, Arne writes that, I love that I never saw it until I really studied the text, how passionately one-sided he is and how he's stating an agenda in Deep Democracy of Open Form, saying, I have an agenda, and my agenda is actually to get people to move from an either-or position of being either a citizen or a participant or a facilitator to what I call participant-facilitator. That's like the first time he actually spells it out. And what that means is he wants us to move, I think, from the participant sort of passively waiting for someone to run the show and possibly even have the solution. So from moving, I'm either in charge and responsible for what happens as a facilitator, or I'm not, and I can just be for the ride to someone who occupies both camps. And this is also true for the facilitator. I think the facilitator thinking that she is responsible or he is responsible for what happens in the group is as out to lunch as the participant who thinks the facilitator is responsible. It's like a co-creative process. We're equally co-responsible, which for German is also a very nice concept, because Germans both feel terribly responsible for what happened during the Third Reich and not at all responsible, you know. And there's a middle way, which is what I love so much about the participant facilitation approach. So, oh, did it? Without me? I guess I'm not going fast enough. Am I, what, actually, does anybody know how much time I've left? 20 minutes? Oh, maybe I'm not moving fast enough. Okay, well, my voice is going, so I'll go fast. I already pointed in that direction. There's another quote in Deep Democracy saying how we are responsible for the quality of our institutions and for the quality of our groups, for the quality of our relationships. And that if we want things to go well, be exciting, being awesome and safe, really, that's really a function of us using our awareness and really seeing ourselves as part of what's going on around us. And I wanted to actually now talk about something that happened in our cohort and on the string. Actually, it started on the string with Errol. And I want to use an example of what I think is participant facilitation in terms of contributing to a community. Now, you know, I work at a university, or maybe you don't know it, and in a kind of a support role. I'll say a little bit more, but the situation that I want to talk about was Errol had posted an announcement or communication on the string saying about your project in Sri Lanka and how well that had gone, and you were very excited. And I was reading it at work, and I was reading this, and I was jealous. That was my, but it was good for Errol, and man, I wish I had a good project like that. I wish, and not only that, I wished I had the courage to shine like you did in that moment. But it was all a kind of internal, kind of somewhat nasty little inner process for me. Remember? I think I even wrote about you saying that I was a little jealous. But what I did, I thought, okay, practice what you preach. This is participant facilitation territory. In that morning, I had been poring over some kind of Excel spreadsheet, looking at results of a competition, a grants competition, which is what I do. I help researchers write grants. And I was looking at it, and we were looking at success rates across Canada, which university had done best and so on. I looked at it and I realized, oh man, our university actually had done better than anyone else. And I thought, damn, there's my chance to share that, because I realized appreciation is also a very underrepresented function. I realized that from what happened when you posted and everybody wrote back saying, fantastic, fabulous, what an inspiration. Do you know how it fed the whole community in a way? So I wrote an email to my superior saying, perhaps you didn't know this, but I just noticed that our university had a 52% success rate when the national average was 30%. And it created a little bit like that, which is very unusual, that some emails were written and my group of co-workers who were responsible for this result were praised. And I thought nothing more of it, but a couple of weeks later, one of the very highly ranking university officials came up to me after a meeting. First of all, he thanked the staff at the end of that meeting, which never happens. And he came up to me and he said, I saw your email. Good work. And I believe, actually, that him thanking and praising the staff was part of that loop of picking up the appreciator and sharing good results, which I think I have you to thank for. No, really. I mean, it's a huge edge, to do that. And I think it had a really beneficial effect. And I wanted to just show with that example how the inner work that I had to do, my own jealousy, my envy, my discontent, my feeling unappreciated, actually putting that out, working on it, unfolding it as an inner work, and then putting it out into the world had a really good effect for the school, for the university, at the highest level. So thank you, Errol, for being so irritating. So anyway, that was one of the projects where I thought I did pretty good. Another way of looking at the participation, coming back to our quote from Arne, he says somewhere in Deep Democracy that history is not an abstract event that happens to others. History is how you facilitate. An amazing thing to say. History is how you facilitate, how you live your day-to-day personal and group processes. I mean, I think that's an amazing saying, an amazing insight, and one that I wanted to take very seriously. I believe that that's true. Actually, and I want you to remember it too. Here I come to my own history, and I come to my childhood, and I come to being 10, 12, 13 years old, a teenager, talking to my parents and learning about Hitler, learning about 6 million Jews who were killed, and saying to my parents, why could you not stop this? Where were you? Could no one do, how could you let this happen? And hearing usually something like, we didn't know, how could we have stopped it? We would have been killed. The stories that I did hear of people who took responsibility in some way, who rebelled, who planned attacks on Hitler or in other ways were politically resistant, didn't come to a good end. Usually they were killed. So I had two extremes. One of the citizen, the participant saying, it has nothing to do with me. We didn't know. We couldn't have done anything. And people saying, we must do something and getting killed. The two positions totally untenable to a 12-year-old, right? You want to identify with a rebel and the resistance movement, but that means you're dead. And you certainly don't want to identify with your parents because that means you're dead in another way. So again, there's a missing figure. Again, the facilitator for me wasn't there. And I think my whole learning, my whole journey to Portland to here has a lot to do with also coming to terms with that question of responsibility and history, and understanding that while I can't go back and make it okay, I can facilitate my everyday interactions, or I have that dual awareness of being in it, but also our training has given me anyhow that other perspective. So that's that. And I believe that in that sense, facilitation is a political act. You know, you hear very often about how facilitators are neutral. In our paradigm, that's not so. I mean, as Arnie would say, there's no such thing as a neutral position. And the best we can do is to know what place we're speaking from, that actually facilitation is, in our paradigm, a very positional act and a very personal act. And that's another thing, how we fill that role, if you think back on that empty carpet role, how we embody that role is very, very personal and must in every case have to do with who you are. And so that the paradigm completes itself through you. You know, it's not something ready to use. It's you have to actually fulfill it. And the political nature of it, I think, is the deep democracy paradigm, the deep democracy in the background, which to me is a very spiritual approach to life. And if you facilitate from that awareness or from that place, that too is political, because you're saying it looks very open, but that in itself is a political stance too. So I want to end, or almost end, this is close to the end now for me. I just wanted to read you that whole quote that Arnie wrote in the introduction of the Deep Democracy book. He says, "Our organizations, communities, and the world can be amazing places to live and work if each of us knows about the responsibility of using our own awareness as a participant facilitator. As participant facilitators, anyone can influence even the most intractable organization. Far from being disempowered individuals in the hands of powerful people and massive world machines, each of us has the ability to stop the cycles of history." I find that very moving, you know, and again, it's not that I can stop Hitler, but I can stop the Hitler that manifests in me. I can't stop him even there. I can, though, pick him up. And to me, that's the best thing I can do with my history. And hopefully stop the cycling of the tyrant and the oppressed in those interactions that I have with my peer group members, with myself. So I find that extremely touching and hopeful and wonderful. And this is on purpose blurring. I want to end with a story of... Oh, it wants to really finish. I want to end with a story that to me sort of embodies the simplicity of participant facilitation. And it involves my friend Susan Kozen, who I wish was here and isn't, but she is. At a time when I think my world was sort of falling apart, my relationship of 16 years was falling apart, Susan was riding with me and my then partner in a car. We were driving back from Portland to Vancouver. It was raining, it was dark. Things were very tense because my partner Al and I had been to therapy, and things didn't look good for the relationship. And anyhow, Susan was coming to stay with us. She was in the backseat of the car, and at the shortly before the border to Canada, we needed gas, and Al was driving, and he made like a totally unsavory turn to get into a gas station. I could just feel myself just getting ready to say something really like, "Fuck God," you know, something nasty and critical. And before I could open my mouth, Susan said, "Great driving, Al. That was a great turn," you know, because yes, he did sort of pull at the last minute. And it stopped World War III, actually. I mean, it before the conflict even had arisen, you know, like a chronic pattern in our relationship of him driving, me being critical, was ended by someone who was sensitive to the scene, who sussed out the field and said one thing and completely diffused the scene, you know. I love Susan for that. I love process work for that. And I love participant facilitation for ending the war before it even starts, the potential of it anyway. So I think that might be it. I don't know if I hurried. Oh, coming back to the train story. Thank you for reminding me. I should have come back a lot longer ago. But in the train, what the inner work was is that I started working with my own altered state, you know, like this rapid heartbeat, the not being able to speak. And when I unfolded it, what came out was actually something quite hysterical and histrionic, and it was something like, if I could have been able to, "For God's sakes, somebody, please do something about this terrible racism here." And it would have matched, I think, to some degree, the histrionic, over-the-top idiocy of the drunken ones. The altered state would have picked up the role of, "I can't do anything." It would have done something. It would have named the racism. And I think it would have been de-escalating because it would have been such an idiotic, you know, it was an idiotic intervention in a way. But you might have done something else. That was it for me in the moment, just going into that rapid heartbeat and that sort of hysterical thing, actually expressing it in the moment might have caused a dialogue to happen, actually, and some processing of what was going on there in that very charged container, you know, where there was people going to a peace demonstration, to a soccer game, and yeah, and that would have probably been a better outcome than those guys getting kicked off the train. But anyway, sorry, I forgot that. But is it? I thought the blurry car story was the way to go. But anyway, that's it. And my voice is now anyhow leaving me. Now, Miss Murphy coached me. I should thank you also. to say at the end of my presentation something. She also wrote it down for me now. It says, "What questions do you have?" And I share this with you. She says, "Don't say, 'Do you have any questions?' That's not so cool. You have to say, 'What questions do you have?' So what questions do you have?" If we have time, I don't know. Is there time for questions? You mean I raced through it? I have so many more quotes, whatever.
That's fine.
But do you think you got a sense of...
That was fabulous.
Thank you. I figure if I can't remember the details to deliver them, it's too much for you guys. So, what questions do you have?
Barbara, I don't have a question, but can I still speak?
Yes.
All right. I just wanted to say I feel like you modeled so well the points that you were trying to make in your presentation, in your stories, that how political and personal the topic is for you, and by explaining it and this and sharing about it, you're modeling that, and it just touches me so deeply, and it helps me answer something about how the personal is political, and it's something, a question I never really understood, yeah. But you use deep democracy to elucidate that, and I just I'm really touched, and I just feel very moved by your presentation.
Thank you, Jennifer. That's one of the things I didn't say is there's a quote that I love too, where Arnie says, "Inner development is organizational development." You know, where you are working on your stuff, working on your jealousy, working on needing appreciation, wanting to be appreciated, being jealous of somebody who is, and picking that up in the moment. That's a case, the little story I told there of organizational development, where one of the VPs in the university actually got something from that and thanked staff in public. One point I wanted to make there as participant facilitation, one of the challenges is actually when you're dealing with rank issues, when you are at a significantly lower rank than the person you need to interact with, because my fallback position there was always, they should know. They are the bosses. They're the, you know, so it's very hard to actually say, well, maybe they don't know. Maybe they don't know that appreciation is needed. And so at that meeting where I actually told you about with the VP thanking the staff, I actually also said that was a great meeting, by the way. You know, you took us through a potentially 3 hours and an hour and a half great facilitation to that guy, which I don't think happens very often, where a person of inferior rank praises a higher ranking. But those are the tricky moments as participant facilitator. You tend to get paralyzed around rank a little bit. I just wanted to share that those are the moments where you really, well, it's not my job. They should know. They're the expert. You know what I mean? So that's, in case you're trying to experiment with it, that's something that took me quite a long time to figure out.
Something? Yes. Can I say something?
Yes.
It's not a question, it's a praise.
Thank you.
Picking up
it's
your
working.
Example.
It's working, yeah.
I don't think I grasped the concept of participant facilitator as well as I do now because of what you said.
Oh.
And I feel like Jennifer, I'm touched by what you've said. I feel like you've brought the concept alive. And I feel, for me, it strikes me, it's almost like it's an antidote to bitterness, how I understand what you just presented. The bitterness of things not going your way, the way you want to see them, and the disempowerment that makes you feel you can't do anything, and an antidote to hopelessness when you feel you don't have the power to make a difference. And for me, that's why it's so touching. It's like there is no place in my life where I couldn't put into practice what you just talked about. So, and deal with any residual bitterness or hopelessness that comes up in a very difficult world to live in. So thank you.
Well, thank you, yeah. It's in Arnie's books.
Yeah, but you brought it alive.
Yeah.
And brought it in together in one package.
But I think that's one of the wonderful tracks to follow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the picture of the train tracks that I showed earlier was a little bit sort of symbolic, too. There's so many tracks we can take through Arnie's work. I'm just taking one and stringing things that are more disparate together to just put it, marginalize everything else he says and just put that into the foreground. So
I just want to follow up with what you just said.
Mm.
To me, that's also, it highlights how important the role of those of us who receive wisdom and teaching from others can be. Like, you know, sometimes you think, oh, I've got nothing to offer. Like it's been said, or it's said better than what I can say, but as receivers, putting together things and re-saying it in our own way can really like shine a light on something, and that it's valuable. And I love those powerful.
Well, it's, I should have said, and I wanted to say that my training is as a literary theorist, which means what do? We read things that exist. We read texts. We analyze very closely things that have been studied for sometimes hundreds of years, and we still keep reading them because every reading produces new insight. Every new generation produces new insight. Every new reading is an act of translation. Like Arnie is translating the shaman and the priest into a 20th century concept, the facilitator. So he is, you know, a translator, and in that way. So yes, exactly. And thank you. What further questions do you have? This is like the hardest part of the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and my question is, I have some experience with me feeling really not having any power, and when I say something, and then it turned out that actually somebody who I thought was really powerful was like,
yeah,
you know, didn't know what to do with what I said, and so there must be some like meta skill about how to bring out your voice.
Don't look to me for an answer.
I mean, you.
You mean generally speaking, how you say? I think that the more of the big you can access when you bring yourself out, the better it's going to go. I really do, because I've noticed that the more invested I am in what I say, the more it seems like I'm launching it at the person, hurling it almost at the person, instead of just putting something out that they can or cannot respond to, you know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think you're right.
I don't want to be right, but...
Well, right, like oftentimes I spend like a little too long, you know, like a percolating, whatever, and then when I say something, it's already kind of loaded.
Yeah. It's picking things up really early. That's another right. thing that Arnie says is the responsible thing to do, the responsive thing to do is to pick up those early inner signals, the rapid heartbeat, the dry mouth, and really work with that the moment it happens, and so that the signals don't have to become so big. That we have a little war, a little conflict. That's what participant facilitation is. It's to take that and bring it in as soon as you can. You're quite right. Everyone does what you say. We stew on the stuff until it explodes. And then that's what makes our world so dangerous. That makes us afraid to open our mouths. That's oppressive in groups. Nobody wants to speak. But that's exactly right, Nikhil.
Thank you.
Well, you're soliciting all the bits that I forgot to say. That's great. Wonderful. Maybe we're done.
Barbara, I just wanted to say a lot of what other people have said already. I feel like that's a huge gift you've given to the community. And I almost want you to give it to Arnie somehow, because it's I know, but to give it back somehow. I don't know in what form, but...
I think that the gift, I think for Arnie, probably the biggest gift is that there are so many people now who can crawl into these little facilitator slots. I think that's the best gift of all, is that there's a program, and so many programs. Just today I read the Deep Democracy Institute. So many wonderful trainings happening everywhere to populate this role, you know? I think that's the best gift, is to just do it. To do it. I mean, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Like embody it. That's the best way. Nobody, you know, that's like the biggest gift we could possibly give on, in my view.
I think I agree, but I agree with what Lee was saying, which is that I've never seen it like this before. And I think to have it brought to life in the way that you've done it is a huge thing.
I'm happy to have done it. It's great, a gift for me. To have been able to do it, and I'm glad it's making a contribution here in this room. And if you find it useful, that's the best thing. Makes me happy. Thank you. Done. Are we done?
Thank you, Barbara.